Service, National Radio Club.
Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for March 2015. This is issue number 362. The address for the DX Audio Service is the National Radio Club, Post Office Box 473-251, Aurora, Colorado, 80047-3251. The email address is sales, S-A-L-E-S, at nrcdxas.org. The musings number is 419-741-0205. A yearly subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S.-Canadian members is $30, and the magazine is published on compact disc. To subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club, Incorporated, and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or you can log on to the website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using PayPal. If you're on the internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal. But subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without anyone else's assistance. Well, without the assistance of anyone else, here is Dave Alpert to present us with a AM switch for the month of March. Dave?
Hi, Dave Alpert with the March issue of AM Switch. I have two editions to cover, AM Switch Volume 82, Issues 7 and 8. We begin with call letter changes. 1080 WYHY, Cannonsburg, Kentucky, changed to WONS, January 23rd. 1270 WXQZ, Twin Falls, Idaho, rechanged, if that's a real word, to KTFI on January 27th. The station was KTFI from 1984 till 2010. So where did the KTFI call come from? 1340 KTFI, Wendell, Idaho, changed to WXQZ, also on January 27th. And we have two more rechanges. 1350 WXTN, San Antonio, Texas, changes back to KCOR after only 33 days as KXTN. And 1590 WASB, Brocksport, New York, changes back to WOKR after almost 31 years as WASB. On the new station watch, 1180 KCKQ, Sparks, Nevada, the CP for this new station, U2, 4,000 watts day, 190 watts night, with pending license to cover and program test authority applications, now applies to modify the night pattern slightly. Fred Vobey says the engineering data shows such a small change he doesn't think it would impact DXers that much. Bozeman, Montana will get a new graveyarder on 1490 as a CP has been tendered by Chaparral Broadcast Company for a new station, U1, 1 kilowatt day, 900 watts night, almost in the center of Bozeman. Fred looked up the application and tells us the tower electrical height is specified as 75 feet, which would be extremely short for 1490. Normally a quarter wave antenna at that frequency would be something like 165 feet. Engineering-wise, a 75-foot tower would yield something like 271 millivolts per meter at 900 watts at night, so coverage will be, let's say, marginal on the fringe. Turning now to construction permits for existing stations. This CP is now on the air, 1320 KXYZ Houston. Their CP for U4, 10 kilowatts day, 5 kilowatts night. The station mostly southwest at night, but those members in Phoenix and Las Vegas might get a whisper of them off the side lobes. CP's built and nearing final licensing. 1450 KEST San Francisco, California applies for a license to cover their CP for U1, 1,000 watts day, 960 watts night from a new site diplexed with the KFSB 1260 transmitter just south of San Francisco. 1580 KGAL Lebanon, Oregon applies for program test authority to use their CP for U2, 5,000 watts day and a kilowatt at night. CP granted to 1480 WSAR, Fall River, Massachusetts. A construction permit for U4, 25,000 watts day, 5,000 at night, replacing an expired CP. That night signal is a hard cardioid to the east, so unless you're in Boston or on the Cape, this will be a hard one to hear. Applications for CP received from 1220 WSRQ Sarasota, Florida. They're applying for U4, 1,000 watts day, and 4 watts night from a new site, Diplex with WWPR 1490. This replaces an old CP which had expired. The night signal goes south towards Sarasota and Fort Myers. 1470 WLQR, Toledo, Ohio. Applies for U4, 1,000 watts day, 690 watts night from a new site in South Toledo, moving from the east side. This also replaces an old CP that expired. The three lobes in the night pattern will shoot toward Jackson, Michigan, and Leamington, Ontario, while protecting the 1470s in Flint and Peoria. Another lobe goes to the south-southwest by Lima, Ohio. 1590 WAUB Auburn, New York applies for U3, 500 watts day and night. At night, the pattern is all north toward Belleville and Kingston, Ontario. Application dismissed. 540 WGOP Pocomoke City, Maryland. The long-standing and controversial application for this station to move to Damascus, Maryland, with U4, 1,000 watts day and night, has been dismissed. Now let's take a look at special temporary authority authorizations. 570 WNAX Yankton, South Dakota, granted an STA with U1, 5,000 watts day, 1,250 watts night. Because their night phaser is inoperative, the station is non-directional, so there is an opportunity to log this one. 620 WMKI Plano, Texas, granted an STA to use night pattern 24 hours a day, reducing day power as needed to maintain monitoring limits. 820 WWLZ Horseheads, New York, granted an STA with U1, 4,100 watts day and 212 watts night, as they can't switch to the night pattern. 1590 WPUL South Daytona, Florida, applies for an STA for temporary site 3.285 miles north of their licensed site. This station also needs to return to the air soon to maintain their license. Applications to extend existing STAs were received from WIOD 610, Miami, Florida, to overcome Cuban QRM, KBUY 1360, Ruidoso, New Mexico, and KLTC 1460, Dickinson, North Dakota. Previously reported applications to extend existing STAs were granted to KAY 1090, Little Rock, Arkansas, and WBTK 1380, Richmond, Virginia, as well as WZHF 1390, Arlington, Virginia. Into the morgue we go now with silent stations. These are stations informing the FCC they are now silent. 970 WERH, Hamilton, Alabama, applied for temporary silent status on January 20th, but says they went silent November 8th, 2012, due to transmitter problems. If this were true, WERH's license is automatically canceled because of being off the air for more than 1 year. 1110 WOMN, Franklinton, Louisiana, went silent January 16th due to ground system and feed line needing repair. 1230 KBWZ, Steamboat Springs, Colorado, fell silent January 23rd to move their studios after the sale of the station. 1230 KLWT, Lebanon, Missouri, went silent January 13th as multiple water pipes broke and damaged much of their equipment. 1310 KIQQ, Barstow, California, is now silent since January 1st due to a vandalism problem from attempted copper thieves. 1490 KRUS, Ruston, Louisiana, silent since November 17th last year when their tower collapsed. 1520 KUNX, Port Hueneme, California, went silent January 21st to complete repairs to their antenna system. 1550 WZRK, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, which at one time was WAUX and WMIR, the owners, WGLB, LLC, have decided to throw in the towel and the license is canceled. by request of the licensee, effective January 15th. And finally, 1570 KPIO in Loveland, Colorado, went silent January 15th, pending a transfer of the station to a creditor. Formerly silent stations informing the FCC they're back and reported heard by DX Audio Service members include 1090 KQNM, Milan, New Mexico, silent since January 1st last year, 1190 KNEK, Washington, Louisiana, off since July 30th, 2014, 1300 WSSG, Goldsboro, North Carolina, had been off since May 6th, 1530 WLWB, New Holstein, Wisconsin, silent since January 26th, 2014, is back on again, heard on January 17th. And 1590 KMIC, Houston, Texas, a one-time Radio Disney station, silent since January 9th, pending a sale to DAIJ Media, is now back on the air and was heard January 23rd with a Spanish religious format. The FCC's cash register has been pretty quiet, but we have one fine to report. Grant Chan's WTRI 1520 in Brunswick, Maryland, has been fined $5,000 for being silent for 7 months without notifying the FCC and requesting permission. Just so DX Audio Service members know, 2 months is the limit for being off the air without notifying the commission. Unless you obtain a silent STA, the FCC assumes you don't want to play radio anymore and cancels your license. Birch Broadcasting's WCXI 1160 in Fenton, Michigan, just to the south of Flint, has been tagged with a $17,000 fine for failing to enclose the station's antenna structure within an effective locked fence and for failing to maintain and make available the issue and program lists in the station's public inspection file. Birch doesn't deny that the antenna structure wasn't properly enclosed and that the program lists were not available for inspection, but argues that it doesn't own the tower site and that the program lists were at the station, just improperly organized. The FCC disagrees and asks them to pay up. In Canada, we have these changes. 1240 CJCS, Stratford, Ontario, applies to move to 107.1 MHz FM. Once that move has been made, the AM days are numbered and it will go silent. 1350 CIRA 5, Gatineau, Quebec, is now silent with transmitter problems. And 1690 CJLO, Montreal, Quebec. This station had an application for an FM repeater on 107.9. It has now been denied, and not because it would block the signal of WVPS 107.9 Burlington, Vermont, in Montreal, where WVPS has many listeners, but because CJLO didn't show a compelling technical need. For what it's worth, Industry Canada and the CRTC, the two agencies similar to the FCC in Canada, have no obligations to protect U.S. stations. Well, that's it for the March DX Audio Service AM Switch. I'd like to thank Sean Axelrod, Bill Hale, Ernest Wasilowski, Hakam Sundman, Fred Volby, David N. Lewis, Terry Kruger, Bill Dvorak, and Glenn Hauser for content and help in this AM Switch. I'm Dave Alpert, and now we throw the big AM switch over to sunny Florida, where Mark Durenberger's working with the Minnesota Twins baseball broadcast folks at spring training. I'm sure you're glad to be out of the snow of Minnesota, Mark.
Thank you, Dave, my friend out there against the balmy Pacific. Well, I'm currently looking at the Gulf of Mexico from a lower latitude, and might just be enjoying warmer temps than you California types. No matter, we're here to sadly declare that this is the penultimate broadcast of the Bandscan after almost two decades. For this visit, we wanted to leave you with some useful DXing information. So in preparing this column, we went back through a folder called DX Projects. And in that folder are all the great ideas I wanted to share over the coming years. The one topic that kept coming up through the list was the idea that maybe we could pass on some further information on medium wave broadcast band propagation, since propagation obviously is key to successful reception of distant signals. I'm not going to adopt a professor in the classroom style. I'm going to try to lay back a little bit, but the fact is there's some quasi-technical information I'm about to throw your way. But I always believe that anything, no matter how complicated, can be understood as long as it's explained correctly. And what follows is our feeble effort to do so, to try to understand a little more about propagation. And before we dig into that, I have to get slightly snarky and opinionated in the spirit of our dear friend Mike Lance. Why is it, he would say, why is it that so many DXers accuse stations of cheating on Day Power at Night when they finally snag that rare catch? Well, in fact, chances are that station wasn't cheating, and that the gods of propagation simply smiled on that DXer's effort. End of rant. Propagation of signals is almost non-predictable. There are some general forecast methodologies, of course, and sharp DXers like Neil Kazaros know how to use those guidelines for maximum opportunity. But most of the time, it just comes down to having your radio in the right place at the right time. In other words, pure luck. Reaction to that super rare catch might be disbelief, but that's why the good Lord invented the recorder. Remember our 2004 tape of the 1-watt signal from Lima, Ohio, 1,300 miles away, captured in the Utah desert? WBZ and WQEW heard out there at high noon. That could only have happened because conditions were just right at that moment in time. We've tried for a repeat of those catches over the years with absolutely no luck. Here's a typical example of a one-of-a-kind summer catch from Minnesota, Cedar City, Utah.
Here's the action on Big Kicking Country, 94.9 FM. You're welcome to the Canyon to town. Hear that game on Talk Radio, 590 AM. Pre-games begin at 6:45, both games kick off at 7 p.m.
KSUB, 1,200 miles, came through in the face of potential interference from KGLE, KID, KCSJ, and of course, the Omaha 590 powerhouse that owns the territory. So what makes us sometimes winners, but more often just tired DXers running out of patience? Simply put, it's being there when that combination of conditions opens the right signal path. In a minute, we'll review what we know about ground wave and sky wave signals, but first let's look at what happens when both ground and sky wave are present. For example, we've all heard interference even on 50 kilowatt stations when we're just a few dozen miles from their big stick. Those stations can suffer self-interference when their direct ground wave signal is combined with the part of the signal off the tower that bounces off the ionosphere. That's the sky wave. It can come back down to collide with the main signal. Here's one example. KYES at 1180. We're about 25 miles away.
I then share with them letters that other youth from Los Angeles wrote to Pope Francis. These LA youth were also involved in criminal activity and were incarcerated, some with life sentences. Thank you for watching the feet of youth like us, one prisoner wrote. We are also young and made mistakes.
Notice that a good signal can suddenly fall apart during self-interference, and notice how the effect comes and goes. The area affected is essentially determined by the height of the transmitting tower. It generally occurs in early evening, and strangely enough, usually in the same approximate distance from the tower. And here's a tip. You can usually tell the difference between self-interference and co-channel interference, where other stations are coming up. Because when co-channel interference strikes, even if you don't hear another voice, there's usually a rapid but consistent beat due to the frequency offset of the stations involved. The self-interference may be one long, slow beat that comes and goes away in an unpredictable fashion. Here's another example. KSTP 1500, we're 50 miles away as they suffer self-interference.
On values worth falling for all October at Subway. Like the Mondulation Meatball Marinara Famous $5 footlong and the fully loaded Black Forest Ham and Cheese $3 6-inch select. And this month's $5 footlong, the Meatball Marinara is and our signature marinara sauce. And the Black Forest Ham and Cheese delivers half a foot of sweet and savory protection as our $3 6-inch select. Enjoy both all October long. Subway, eat fresh.
Limited time only, but that's right.
This is Ann.
No, good.
From
the bakery to the market, morning after morning.
Because during normal daylight hours, no skywave is bounced back to Earth, the so-called daytime signals are relatively constant, as we know, until you reach late afternoon, when skywave can start to interfere. That effect usually begins at the high end of the dial and works its way down. That means you're more likely to hear skywave from high-end stations first, before you hear that from low-end stations. So, for example, given the same time of late afternoon, the skywave interference will be worse on a station at 1500 than one at 760. Put it another way, the 1500 signal will suffer skywave interference sooner than the one at 760. To help you decide whether a distant target station is potentially attainable, it's useful to review some signal transmission basics. We know the signal components clashing with each other, and our examples are, of course, the skywave and the groundwave, or what's sometimes called the surface wave. The groundwave signal has its own physical restraints, but these behaviors are somewhat predictable. The groundwave, as we know, follows the curvature of the Earth. That's why we can hear daytime signals quite a distance from us, if there's good power from the tower. 100 miles is not unusual for a 50-kilowatt station, again, depending on the frequency. The ground wave's reach is determined by transmit power and the height of the tower, but it's also very dependent upon the nature of the ground over which the signal travels. Ground conductivity and terrain roughness can affect the signal attenuation. Better ground conductivity means better reach. There are maps of the United States that lay out this ground conductivity. The Rabbit DXer uses these and other tools to estimate what sort of luck he might have. In addition, there's something called ground signal penetration. It varies. It's greater at the low end of the medium wave band, poorer at the high end. In Minneapolis, we have 50 kilowatters at 830 and 1500. WCCO's 830 signal is far more powerful to the average radio at the same distance from both antennas, due to its lower frequency and thus better ground signal penetration. Back in the 1930s, when most of today's big AM tower farms were being built, designers took great care in evaluating the ground conditions in a large region surrounding the desired tower site. WLS has a situation where excellent ground conditions to the southwest means their signal gets a bit of an added boost in that direction. Another obvious characteristic of ground wave propagation is that signal strength decreases with the distance from the tower. No surprise, but we point this out to remind us that unless a station is fairly close, signals can be inherently weak and hard to catch in the first place. Now add to that the increasing amount of noise and interference on the band, and we have the apartment dweller's dilemma. Over the years, we've offered suggestions for how to beat down that noise to give you a fighting chance. Of course, there's only so much you can do. But it's still possible for that rare occurrence when the reception gods have all smiled at the same time and you've made some progress in eliminating local noise. And voila, there it is, the signal you've been looking for years. Okay, given the case where you're looking for a certain station within, say, a few dozen to 100 miles or less, your reception's likely to be almost ground wave. But I guess we've learned the real fun is skywave reception because it's so unpredictable. So let's talk about skywave for a bit. Day or night, a certain amount of signal leaves the station tower along the ground, and another portion also heads skyward. That's because no radio tower can be 100% efficient in putting all the signal on the ground, and the amount of that signal that goes skyward is dependent on the length of the tower. While we DXers are happy for the fact that all stations send some signal skyward, up through the atmosphere and up to the ionosphere for bounce back. Based on what we'll learn in a moment, we know that for any specific station, its skywave signal could come back down to your radio in several different locations at the same time. The very randomness of these locations is what makes DXing so much fun. So how does this work? Let's visualize several invisible layers hovering over the Earth in order of height. The major ones are the atmosphere, and well above that, the ionosphere, where the real radio action takes place. Inside the ionosphere, there are several layers of ionized particles. They're called the D, E, and F layers, the F layers being the highest of interest to broadcast band or shortwave listeners. There are other layers beyond that, but we consider them irrelevant. Let's call the E and F layers, those higher layers, the radio mirrors. And if all we're interested in is medium wave, we can forget about the F layer. It also acts like a mirror, but its greatest effect is in the higher frequency short wave bands. And that lets us focus on the E layer, our radio signal trampoline at about 75 to 90 miles above the Earth. The signal leaves the tower at some angle, hits the E layer, and bounces back to Earth. That's how Skywave works, as simply as we can put it. Well, why doesn't that mirror work during the day? Because something gets in the way, absorbing the signals so they don't get through to the E layer. That absorber is the D layer, and it's located below the E layer, where it gets in the way of the radio signals. This D layer filter, if you will, is most effective during daylight hours because the sun charges its particles, and that turns this area into a signal sponge. Then, when the sun isn't overhead to stir up the D layer, signals pass through it, and we have skywave reflection. Hence, superior nighttime distance reception. Well, now that generally holds true. The signal is usually absorbed, but during the winter season, and especially at the low part of a sunspot cycle, daytime signals can get through the D layer. And if they do, they hit the E layer mirror and can be bounced back to Earth. That's why, sometimes in winter, you will copy stations from a long way away, as we did that time in the desert with WBZ and WQEW. So, we need to call that D layer an imperfect radio filter. Now, if you're still with us, we conclude that at night, when the sun is no longer charging things, the D layer opens up and all medium wave radio signals reach the E layer and are bounced back to Earth. Well, again, not totally, because the D layer doesn't completely disappear at night. And that situation adds yet more randomness. The sun's activity that activates the D layer during the day can sometimes keep that layer partially active at night. Solar flares, changes in X radiation, other crapola coming from our beloved sun can partially energize the D layer, even when the sun isn't over our part of the globe. So, when people complain about the band being dead at night, it's usually because of these effects. And, oh, incidentally, when this is happening, when the D layer is active at night, the low end of the broadcast band is the first affected. So, if you're tuning around and you don't notice any long-distance low-end stations at night, but yes, some high-end stations are getting through, that's probably because parts of the D-layer filter are still being energized. That's a lot of stuff. So, thanks for your patience through all of this. It's been said of people like me, ask them what time it is and they'll tell you how to build the watch. Let's get back on track. Let's examine a signal that's headed skyward from the tower. It's not absorbed by the D layer. It makes it to the E layer, then heads back down at an angle and hits the Earth at whatever distance that angle portends. Distances anywhere from the aforementioned 25 to 35 miles and as much as 3,500 miles away, and often in more than one unpredictable place. And then there's the multi-hop situation, where the signals bounce back up again and come down yet again somewhere else. And of course, with each hop, and there are many stations that go through these, the signal predictably is weakened. Have you worked in auroral conditions? Reception areas affected during auroral conditions are oval-shaped. Within them, you can go from zero reception to enhanced reception. You experience rapid fades, weird co-channel happenings, all depending on what impact the sun is having on the Earth at that moment, even when it's not overhead. Auroral conditions. Here's a new one for me. High latitude path skewing. Now don't run away. As the signal makes its way in your direction, it tends to want to follow the most robust path. So when the direct path from tower to you is not wide open, and conditions are weird up there, it's not unusual for a signal to arrive from a different direction than the tower is located. Example, you know the tower is east of you, but your antenna might get the best signal from the southeast. This effect is more likely to occur in northern locations. We haven't mentioned gray line DXing. When the sky overhead is transitioning from darkness to sunlight, you have a far better than even chance to hear stations on the other side of the world where the transition is going the other way, from sunlight to darkness. The edges of that area without sunlight can be hot, so gray line DXing can be especially rewarding. And finally, there's the so-called midwinter anomaly, when all bets are off. I always thought DXers invented this condition when they couldn't explain what else was going on, sort of like the quark or the gluon. This condition, the midwinter anomaly, is blamed for signal problems when you'd expect conditions to be otherwise very good. This one, too, usually occurs at northern locations. So with all that said, it can be tough to predict what reception will be like when you go for that distant station. Sirius DXers use published numbers on solar activity for a rough prediction, but you just never know. The bottom line is, it's always different, and that's the challenge of DXing and the stimulus that keeps some of us listening night after night. Nowhere will you better experience the vagaries of propagation than when you copy a far distant station, even though there are other stations on the same frequency between you and the catch. I call these catches hopovers. Listen.
Oh, sometimes it causes me to tremble. Where you
with KHWG 750 AM Fallon.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
That is KHWG Fallon, Nevada on 750, heard in western Colorado. What you didn't know is that a co-channel 10 kilowatter KOAL in Price, Utah was right between KHWG and our antenna. But KOAL isn't in there at all. Here from an antenna in Minnesota, 1060 in Longmont, Colorado.
Support those who protect our freedom, provide security, keep us safe, and help our kids. www.proudtoservecoffee.com.
KRCN, Longmont, Denver, Fort Collins. AM 1060, The Biz.
Congratulations. You're pre-approved to listen to Thinking Out Loud.
Now, we have a local on 1060, and there are strong signals in the way from KGFX in Pierre, South Dakota, and another station in Nebraska, right in the way of Longmont, but not heard. Another, Wyoming hopping in. KZMQ showed up in spite of the powerhouse in Sioux Falls. That's right in line with the antenna. On that same day, because propagation was working for us, KIML in Wyoming hopped over stronger stations KLXX and KNWC, either or both of which should have bombed in here.
Fox Overtime with Andy Furman and Kirk Morrison. Sundays at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific.
You're listening to KIML Gillette.
All medical resources. Stop by and see what's new in the CPAP map. We're across from Rockpile Museum.
So you just never know. Now, with all that in mind, hopefully you'll understand a little better why we spent so much time boring you with our reports from the Utah desert over the years. It was because the antenna we were using was especially sensitive to signals from a certain sky angle and thus a certain area in the ionosphere, and it took being out in the wide open spaces to set up that kind of antenna. It'd be like we had a narrow funnel pointed at this specific part of the sky. And it's because we knew that signals hitting that part of the sky were constantly changing. And that's why we spent so much listening time out there. Because every night there'd be different signals coming through the funnel as the mirror effect of the ionosphere kept changing. Now, no one ever suggested the beverage antenna in the desert was by any means the only way or the ultimate way to have fun, and it's probably not the best way. Everyday DXers whoop and triumph over that latest rare catch. Ultralighters rack up thousands of stations from their pocket portables. The study of propagation remains an imperfect science. The effect is completely and eternally variable. And while we could spend another 30 band scan columns suggesting how you might create the best chance to hear that rare signal, it all comes down to luck. And that's why this month's comments, to give you some solid reasons you should never give up DXing, because it does happen. That rare catch will come zooming in to your eternal satisfaction. We hope there was something useful to you in the last 20 minutes or so. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. We're lucky enough to visit with you on one more DX Audio Service band scan column. Until then, good listening, DXers.
Are you ready for some Fort Wayne? Save the dates July 10th, 11th, and 12th for the DX Convention 2015. That's this year's joint gathering of the International Radio Club of America, the Worldwide TV-FM DX Association, DECALCOMANIA, and the National Radio Club in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Writes Scott Feibusch, "We're in the final stages of nailing down a hotel contract and thus the cost for the registration, and we'll be opening the registration process in March. But in the meantime, here's what to expect. A hotel cost of approximately $99 or less a night, and a registration fee of $50 or less. We'll kick things off on Friday, July 10th, with some station tours during the day and a baseball game at night, as we'll visit Parkview Field in downtown Fort Wayne to see the Fort Wayne Tin Caps, a single-A Midwest League affiliate of the Padres, play in one of the nation's newest and most impressive minor league ballparks. On Saturday, we'll have educational sessions, and maybe a tour or two, during the day, and a DX banquet in the evening, followed by the famous auction, and plenty of time for chats in our meeting room and lounge. Sunday, we'll have the DX quiz before closing the official convention activities. And if you're still in town and don't have a rush to catch a flight, how about a visit to the Auburn Cord Duesenberg Auto Museum or the Three Rivers Festival, which will be underway when we're in town? Stay tuned for the registration details coming soon. And in the meantime, get your vacation schedules in place and start making your plans to join us in Fort Wayne for a wonderful weekend." Rootstown Radio goes silent after internal struggles. This story is by Zach Taylor, life editor, in the Charleston Daily Mail newspaper. Josh Schreiber, volunteer engineer for WXDB, Rootstown Radio, unwraps a cover for their microwave antenna on the roof of the Union Building, which will beam a signal to their antenna 26 miles away. The low-power Americana radio station is set to launch by the end of August. Alasha Al-Kudwa and Emirate Pepper co-hosts Beats Without Borders, a world music program on the now-defunct community radio station 97.5 WXDB. Al-Kudwa and Pepper hope to continue their show, either on another community radio station or possibly online. Program director Burr Beard sits in the control room of WXDB Rootstown Radio, located in the Union Building. The low-power Americana radio station went silent last week after a run of just 6 weeks. A little more than 6 weeks after it went on the air, Charleston's first community radio station is nothing but static. The community radio station collapsed in a heap of dysfunction. Burr Beard, 95.7 FM WXDB's vice president and station manager, moved to West Virginia earlier this year to set up the volunteer-run low-power FM station. He spent months raising money for the project, collecting thousands of dollars from local donors. The station's parent organization, Rootstown Radio, received a $9,000 grant from the Greater Kanawha Valley Foundation, a $1,000 grant from the Tamarack Artesian Foundation, and $1,000 from a crowdfunding campaign on the website Indiegogo. The station also held several fundraising concerts to help pay the bills. Beard organized and trained a cadre of dedicated volunteer disc jockeys who began broadcasting on the local airwaves on September 7th, playing a wide variety of music from classic music, classic country, bluegrass, classic rock, Americana, gospel, and more. But the music stopped last Monday. That day, Rootstown President Dawn Warner, Beard's ex-girlfriend, contacted the Federal Communications Commission and surrendered the station's construction permit, shutting it down for good. The reasons behind the demise of WXDB is different depending upon who you ask. Volunteers blame Warner. They say she created a toxic environment at the fledgling station, alienating staff members with a heavy-handed management style, while remaining largely absent from WXDB's day-to-day operations. Warner, meanwhile, alleges the volunteers attempted to wrestle control of the station away from her and Beard. Emails obtained by the Daily Mail provide a glimpse into the drama. Volunteers say around the second week of September, Warner and Beard ended their romantic relationship. WXDB's engineer Larry Hodgkins said that Warner notified volunteers Beard was fired from the station. Someone also posted an announcement on the station's Facebook page that said Beard would no longer have any affiliation with WXDB. But things had changed by Monday, September the 15th. In an email, Warner confirmed that she and Beard would remain owners of WXDB. Her attempt to fire Beard apparently worried WXDB volunteers, however. Emmett Pepper, co-host of the WXDB's world music show Beats Without Borders, suggested the station's parent organization add two additional board members to serve as secretary and treasurer. He expressed concern that Warner's son, Nemo, was serving on Rootstown Radio's governing board despite having no involvement with the station. Pepper said that one of the new board members could serve as Nemo's replacement. "I speak only for myself, but given what has happened over the past month, I'm very uneasy being involved with this organization under the previous current structure, which has proven to be highly volatile," Pepper wrote in a small group email on September the 25th. Volunteers were also becoming concerned that, despite repeated promises to move from Pennsylvania, Warner never made it to West Virginia. Beats Without Borders co-host Alasha L. Kudwa expressed this sentiment in a September 26th email to Beard, Warner, and others involved at the station. "Dawn doesn't live in West Virginia," she wrote. "Why is she president? I don't have anything against her or any of you, just against the actions that have caused a lot of drama and negativity." Warner responded later that day in a tersely worded email. "The fact is, I am president, and that's not going to change. That's not going to be me being bossy or pushy. That's simply a fact that both Burr and I felt needed to be explained," she wrote. "Burr and I need to regain control of this unfortunate situation. We either move forward together or let the past be the past, or I'm concerned about WXDB's future." A few hours later, Warner sent another email with a much different tone. She apologized for any previous email, expressing her appreciation for the volunteers' hard work, and promised to replace Nemo and add a secretary-treasurer to the governing board. Let's leave the past where it belongs and move on, she wrote. But on September 29th, Beard sent out another email announcing Warner's departure. Dawn decided to stay in Pennsylvania with her family and friends and will not be part of WXDB. She was happy to hand over the reins of the station to me. We are breaking up our previous business and personal relationship and are keeping it up with a friendly level of communication, he wrote. This alone would have probably been the death blow for the station. FCC regulations forbid stations with pending licenses, like WXDB, from replacing more than 50% of their governing board members. The departure of Warner and her son meant two-thirds of the original board was now gone. But Beard and the volunteers held on to hope. He assured them that he was here to stay and be your leader and urged the team to move forward. On October 6, volunteers received another email from Beard, announcing that he was taking the week off. He said he lost his job with Friends of Old Time Music and Dance, where he was the arts administrator, and needed to find new work. Steve Ballman, a FootMad board member, said both Beard and the organization agreed that he would quit. The stress and difficulties of the radio stations kind of overwhelmed him, Ballman said. In his email, Beard made it clear he would not leave Charleston, however. I am not going back to Pennsylvania or leaving the station. Rootstown Radio will prevail, he wrote. On Monday, October 13th, 1 week before the station would go dark, Beard sent another email to volunteers announcing that he would step down as station manager but remain a board member. 5 days later, on Saturday, October 18th, Beard sent the volunteers an email announcing his complete departure from WXDB. I think I got myself in too deep. My time for starting up a new station came, happened, and went some 25 years ago, he said. On Monday, Beard forwarded staffers an email from James Bradshaw, Deputy Division Chief of the FCC's Media Bureau Audio Division. Please treat this email as the official notification of the cancellation of the construction permit per the request of Rootstown Radio, Bradshaw wrote. The email also included a note from Warner and Beard saying that WXDB call letters were deleted from the FCC's database. There is no legal authority whatsoever to continue to operate the station, they wrote. Beard, in a short phone interview last Wednesday, said he was moving back to Pennsylvania. When asked about the closure of the station, he said he didn't feel like talking about it right then. He has not responded to multiple requests to follow up with an interview. Rookie mistakes. Warner's story of WXDB's demise is quite different than staff members' accounts. The volunteers bullied me out of my moving down there and wanted to take control of the station, she said. You have a group of volunteers that never have done radio before, never had experience with it, and it all goes to their head. Warner said the DJs were not providing station identification at the beginning of each hour, which is required by the Federal Communications Commission, and said some DJs were allowing profanity to go out over the air. She also alleges the station was violating FCC rules because WXDB's antenna was not installed at the height specified by its construction permit. Radio stations receive construction permits before being granted a full license to allow the stations to test their equipment. Worried the FCC might fine her or Beard, Warner says that she wrote a letter asking the agency to terminate WXDB's construction permit. Beard decided he was leaving the station because he had lost control over it. To protect ourselves from any FCC violations, that was the only thing we could do, she said. The only way we could not become liable legally was to surrender the construction permit. Hodgkins acknowledges radio station hosts sometimes forgot to give the station ID at the required times, and profanity sometimes crept onto the airwaves, but he said volunteer DJs were not intentionally skirting the FCC rules. They just did not have much experience in radio. It wasn't DJs cussing on the air. It was songs that had profanity in them, because they never previewed the songs before, he said. It's standard practice for radio stations to preview every song that they play on the air, no matter what. Hodgkins said WXDB's amateur DJs were not aware of how important this is and how to do the due diligence, so some explicit language slipped through on broadcasts. I chalk that up to rookie mistakes. I don't think anything was intentional, he said. He said problems with the station's antenna could have been fixed with a little paperwork. Hodgkins says that the station had some troubles getting the antenna installed on West Virginia Public Broadcasting's radio tower, since the state's government's new vendor hiring system did not include any approved tower climbers. But by the time WXDB finally got its antenna installed, it was only installed at about 50 feet instead of the 100 feet specified in the construction permit. But Hodgkins says that the station only needed to modify its construction permit with the FCC to accommodate the new antenna height. It wasn't like it was set in stone, he said. Every WXDB staffer who spoke to the Daily Mail for this story denies Warner's accusations that volunteers tried to bully her or Beard out of the station. And while none claimed to have a close relationship with Warner, many expressed feelings of sympathy for Beard. Burr Beard did a really great job at pulling together some of the best people, most knowledgeable, and most connected musicians and music lovers in the area. We had a really great station going, Pepper said. It's not a good idea to mix your business with your personal relationships, and I think this is an example of that. A silver lining. Despite the demise of WXDB, community radio in Charleston might not be dead. Chris Long, a local critical care nurse and chief operating officer of Pulmonary Associates in South Charleston, is working up to set up his own low-power FM radio station. The FCC did not accept his initial low-power application because of a problem with his chosen frequency, but Long is in the process of reapplying. He's working with the Prometheus Radio Project, a Philadelphia-based group that seeks to help communities start low-power FM stations. They're very optimistic that with the reapplication on the right channel, I should be able to be approved, he said. He said the Prometheus Project has warned him the process will take at least 3 months, however. Long also says that he's in preliminary talks to assume control of WXDB's equipment. We're thinking we can easily turn the keys over to my organization, he says. All of the volunteers are still interested. All is not lost. It's a very big silver lining. Warner said Beard left everything associated with WXDB in Charleston. We walked away from everything, the assets, equipment, computers, antenna. That is all there in Charleston for this group of volunteers. We did not take any of that, she said. It is unclear, however, who owns the WXDB equipment. Because Rootstown Radio was not a registered nonprofit organization, it partnered with FootMad, which served as the station's physical agent. FootMad received donation money from the Greater Kanawha Valley Foundation and other donors on behalf of Rootstown Radio, then made the purchases for the station. Ballman, who was FootMad's treasurer at the time of the Greater Kanawha Valley Foundation grant, said there is no money left in the station's account, but wonders if his organization now owns the equipment purchased for WXDB. That's a murky question, and we're seeking legal advice to figure that out, he said. Ballman said FootMad has no interest in using the equipment, but would like to hand it over to another community radio group. It may not be that simple. Sherry Ryder, senior program officer with the Greater Kanawha Valley Foundation, said no one notified her group that WXDB has gone off the air. Ryder was not aware the radio station was defunct until a Daily Mail reporter called her last week. Even though FootMad served as the station's fiscal agent, Ryder says the organization does not own WXDB's equipment. They would need to contact us, and we would need to see if we could work something out, she said. Ryder said in the past, organizations have returned grant money to the foundations when projects failed. Other times, the foundation's board has required the money, or items purchased with the money, to be given to another organization. On some occasions, the foundations has not received anything back. The money was given, it was gone, and the organization was gone, Ryder said. She said the fate of WXDB's equipment ultimately rests in the hands of the foundation's board of directors. The fate of the station's legacy, the volunteer DJs who, however briefly, filled the air with unique programs, is also unsettled. Al Kudwa said that she initially wanted to help with WXDB because community radio stations allow DJs a large amount of freedom to choose music for their shows. That's inspiring to me, she said. I'm obsessed with the world music and instrumental music. I think it's important for people to hear all those kinds of sounds. She's determined to continue her efforts even without WXDB and said that other DJs feel the same way. Al Kudwa and Pepper are also looking for ways to take Beats Without Borders to other audiences, perhaps online. They had a few dozen people listening online during their first few shows, which they considered a success for an unknown show on an unknown radio station. The duo, like many former WXDB hosts, has also agreed to join Long's station whenever he gets it running. But Al Kudwa said that she's disappointed WXDB didn't work out. I feel very sorry for Burr, honestly. He had a big vision for this radio station, she said. When love gets involved, everything gets messy. This has been Rootstown Radio Goes Silent After Internal Struggles, and it was written by Harold Zack, life editor, in the Charleston's Daily Mail newspaper. You can contact Zack at area codes 304-348-4830 or zack.harold@dailymailwv.com. And for the DX Audio Service, I'm Fred Vobey in Lima, Ohio. As you recall, at the end of December, I told the National Radio Club's board of directors that I would be stepping down as publisher of the DX Audio Service. I asked the board to find a successor if they wished for the DX Audio Service to continue. As of today, no such replacement has been announced, and unless someone steps up soon as a new publisher, the National Radio Club has indicated that it will no longer offer the DX Audio Service. Should the National Radio Club not find a publisher and the magazine cease to become a National Radio Club publication, the club's bylaws provide that the balance of your dues and subscriptions would be refunded to you. This refund would presumably come from the National Radio Club's treasury in Louisville, Kentucky, and be managed via the sales address mentioned at the beginning of the magazine, since that is where your subscriptions and dues were paid. Keep in mind that none of your subscription fees were banked by me, but instead were forwarded on to the National Radio Club. I therefore cannot help you recover those fees, so please don't call or write me for refund assistance. You simply need to contact the club at the address and email at the start of the magazine. And no, I don't have a phone number for the management at the National Radio Club. In fact, one of the board of directors refused to give me his telephone number. By the way, your refund would be based on the number of issues left on your subscription times $2.50 per issue. So rest easy. Don't fret. You won't lose any money if the DX Audio Service is no longer being published by the National Radio Club. The National Radio Club's board is supposed to be searching for a new publisher. So, as the May issue comes closer, a refund may be moot.
It's time for a pattern change. Or at least to flip over your tape for more of the DX Audio Service.